Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Some of the most memorable shows as you look back over 17 and a half years of Unbelievable?
That is a tough one.
What about some of the shows where perhaps they were memorable for maybe the wrong reasons?
Perhaps the one that's become best known though on the show for the kind of going viral for perhaps the wrong reasons.
Why do you still believe in God after, well, more than 10 years now of listening
Absolutely.
To atheists?
Yeah, I mean, maybe there'll be an update. Why I'm still a Christian after 20 years of talking about it. But, well, I think if it were down to sort of just one thought, it would simply be that...
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, hello and welcome to this week's edition of the show, which will be rather different to usual. I'm Justin Brierley and I'm joined by Ruth Jackson. Hello, Ruth.
Hey, Justin.
And today we are taking a look back at 17 plus years of the Unbelievable show for reasons that will become apparent towards the end of today's show, when we're also going to be joined by Christian philosopher and apologist Dr. Vince Vitale. But yeah, we're doing something a bit different today, aren't we, Ruth?
Yeah, we are. And actually, because of that, we thought it'd be quite fun to spend the first part of today's show turning the mic on you, if that's okay, Justin. I know that's not normally what you do, but I guess I just wanted to ask sort of what are some of the highlights of your 17 and a half years hosting the Unbelievable show? So I guess, you know, the obvious first question is... how did it all start? Why don't you take us right back to the beginning? Yeah. What was the first episode? Why did you start the show?
Well, let me go right back to the beginning, which is probably at some point in the year 2005, when I had been working at Premier Christian Radio for about 3 years at that point, I would say. And I went to the CEO, Peter Kerridge, and said, I think there's space in our schedule for doing something that's different from Christians talking to Christians about Christian things, which is important and is an important part of what you do. But how about we model what it would look like to talk to non-Christians as well? Because most of us spend most of our time, especially in the very secularized West, talking and being around non-Christians. So I said, why don't we create a show where we sort of model conversations between Christians and non-Christians? And that was how Unbelievable was born. It had this, you know, once a week slot on a Saturday afternoon, and it was live at the time. So we took listener calls during the show. But the normal format was that I was joined by a Christian and a non-Christian to discuss faith and belief. And we decided to call it Unbelievable with a question mark, because we wanted to be asking from week to week, is this stuff believable? Mm. Does it make sense? Can we actually make an intellectual case for Christian faith? And yeah, and that's where it all started.
So what was the first ever episode of Unbelievable?
Well, the very first episode of Unbelievable was Father John Twistleton, who I still know. He's an Anglican priest, and he had been involved with Premier Christian Radio for some time. And his neighbour, his atheist neighbour, Clive. Do you want to hear a little bit of that very first time I opened
yes,
the microphone
please.
For an edition of Unbelievable? All right,
I mainly want to hear if your voice has changed, Justin.
Oh, this is going to be really weird. Very weird indeed. But yeah, here we go. Cycle back 17 and a half years with me. And these were the first moments of the first Unbelievable show.
That's After the Fire with Forged from Faith. 9 minutes past 12 here on Premier Christian Radio. You're listening to a brand new show, Unbelievable, with me, Justin Brierley. And as I explained before the song, we're going to be inviting each week a non-Christian into the studio to explain why they don't believe in God or Jesus or Christianity generally. And it's my pleasure to welcome into the studio this week two special guests for today's show. It's Clive Bootle and Father John Twistleton. Good morning to you both, gentlemen.
Hi, Justin.
Good to have you here. Let me start off with you, Clive, because very much the phone-in will be centering around some aspects of what you believe. You're an atheist, Clive. Just define for me what, to you, an atheist means exactly.
Well, I mean, just a lack of belief in God and the existence of God. That's what it means to me. I'm sorry to say that I'm not a fire-breathing atheist. I just don't believe in God.
Right.
There you go. Those were the opening moments of our first Unbelievable show. And that was, Ruth, believe it or not, on the 26th of November, 2005. And my oldest son, who's now 18, was still less than a year old at that point. Wow. So it's been a long, long time.
Wow. I love that. I'm not a fire-breathing atheist. So I'm sorry. I love that he apologises for that.
We've had a few of those on the show since, I can tell you. But no, Clive was lovely. He was very gentle, very, very, very sweet.
So when did the show first become a podcast? Because it was a radio show, like just a radio show for quite a long time, wasn't it? When did it then become a podcast? Because that was quite a change in direction.
It was in some ways. We were happily broadcasting for a couple of years just on radio, just really reaching a Christian audience on radio for the first couple of years. We did move it to a sort of pre-recorded format within the first year or so, partly because I wanted my weekends back. So. And that kind of changed the format a bit as well. Whereas before there were a lot of kind of, you know, listener questions and phone-ins that would happen and take it off in all kinds of interesting directions. It was a little bit more focused on the topic under discussion once we went to the pre-recorded format. But it was definitely a big shift once we started podcasting the show. And we were quite early adopters. So this would have been in 2007 that we started podcasting the show. And at that time, that was still pre, you know, smartphones and iPhones and things. So podcasting was still something people tended to do either on their laptop or, you know, with the very early sort of MP3 players, downloading it at home and taking it with you on the go. But it was interesting because once we did start doing that, once we started putting it essentially out on the internet rather than just on the airwaves in the UK, suddenly a global audience started to tune in. And it wasn't, you know, huge numbers to start with, but we did start to see significant numbers of non-Christians as well as Christians starting to respond to the show. So if ever I had a fairly well-known atheist on the show, they would then perhaps post the podcast to their blog, wherever, in due course to social media as that took off. And it was interesting to see suddenly a number of responses starting to come in from non-Christians. And so the way that it really changed the show for me was that it gave it an international flavour, a lot more listeners from overseas, the US, Canada, Australia. But also it made it feel like it was a genuine meeting place between Christians and non-Christians, not only on the show, but also in the listeners who were listening to the show. And that for me made me feel all the more that I had a responsibility to try and be fair, neutral, objective as far as I could be, even as a Christian sitting in the moderator's seat, to sort of remember that it wasn't just Christians listening. It was plenty of non-Christians. And I wanted to make sure that they felt included, that they felt their voice was being heard and properly represented. So for me, that was quite significant, taking it out of the kind of Christian media sphere and putting it into that wider public sphere.
Yeah. Well, do you have a clip of one of the first podcasts or a podcast that you think was particularly significant, I guess, in growing that non-Christian audience?
Yeah, well, the one that I thought of when it comes to sort of the podcasting was I remember I was getting a sort of a regular sort of breakdown of our statistics and just seeing them gradually organically creep up. And I remember the first show that got over 10,000 downloads. That for me was quite significant. Yeah. And the first show that actually got over 10,000 downloads was in 2009. And it was the first time I had Bart Ehrman on the show. Now, you'll know Bar-Ehrman Ruth. He's a well-known New Testament scholar. He's a critic. He's an agnostic. In fact, he's just featured on the show on our latest season of The Big Conversation in dialogue with Justin Bass. But this was the first time I had him on back in 2009. He'd just written a best-selling popular book called Misquoting Jesus, in which he essentially was asking whether we can really trust the transmission of the New Testament documents over time because of all the copying errors and variances between the various manuscripts and so on. And I remember when I read this book, I was like a bit like taken aback. I was like, ooh, he's got some good arguments, this Bar-Ehrman. But I thought, well, I've invited him on the show. I better find someone who can do a good job opposite him. And the person I brought on with him was Peter J. Williams, who himself is a biblical scholar from Cambridge. And they just had a fantastic discussion. And we'll hear a clip from it in just a moment's time. But for me, this was a show which really did sort of raise the bar, because it was one of those shows where for the first time on our show, we were bringing two of the key voices in this debate together and creating something entirely new. And it became a significant show. You know, people were sharing it, not just, you know, in lay circles, but in academic circles, you know, people who wanted to really hear the best of the both arguments on both sides. So so shall we just play a little bit?
Yeah, let's have a listen.
So this is, as I say, Bar-Ehrman and Peter J. Williams. And this was part of their debate on whether we can trust the transmission of the New Testament, given the many variations we find between manuscripts and so on. So here's just a little bit of their discussion.
So if Paul writes a letter in the year 50, you would love to have a copy from the year 50 or from the year 51 or the year 52. But unfortunately, we don't have a copy until, say, the year 200, 150 years later. And we don't have a complete set of Paul's letters until the about 350. So we're talking hundreds of years of copying in which scribes are not only making their own mistakes, but reproducing the mistakes of their predecessors. And so there's this enormous gap between when Paul wrote and our earliest copies of his letters.
Well, we'll come to some of the specific examples as we go. But Peter, I mean, is your view of this the same as Bart's, that there is really an awful lot of time in which stuff could have changed just in the natural course of making copies and then copies of those being made and copies of those being made? And the fact that for many documents in the New Testament, there has elapsed a couple of centuries before we have, if you like, the first copies available to us.
Well, in one sense, our views are the same, in the sense that we will have exactly the same, roughly the same dates of documents from the time of writing of a New Testament book to its earliest copy. However, I think I would tend to see the glass as half full, whereas Bart would see it as half empty. In fact, obviously, the gap that there is between the earliest copy of a New Testament writing and when it was written is less for most New Testament texts than it is for classical writings. And so really, I see this as a matter of presentation. I think Bart tends to focus rhetorically on the negative and on the issue of how much things change, whereas he doesn't focus the same amount on how much they stay the same despite copying. So
what you're saying is, rather than say, look how much it's changed, you would say, well, look how remarkably similar these are.
In one sense, I would say focus on both. What I think Bart would tend to do is to actually dramatize change. So when we have, for instance, talk about there being hundreds of thousands of differences in New Testament manuscripts, and that's more than there are words in the New Testament, I'd say, well, that's one of those fairly useless statistics. It's a bit like me saying, well, there are maybe a couple of million sides of New Testament manuscript. We've only got hundreds of thousands of differences in a couple of million sides of manuscript, each of which may have hundreds of letters on. And therefore, you know, there aren't many specific errors per page. Isn't this remarkably well copied? Well, I won't use that argument, but it's the sort of thing that one can do. And I'm not sure it gets us very far. We're both agreed that a large number of these differences can be shown to be secondary. So the question really is, how many variants are there in the manuscripts which might seriously contend for being the original? How much uncertainty is there at that level? I don't know that anyone's really made a proper study of that. And to some extent, the level of uncertainty you think there is about the New Testament text comes from the method you adopt to establish the New Testament text.
Do you think part of the popularity of Unbelievable is what's being done there? People are taking these incredibly sort of complex academic arguments and bringing it into the vernacular, into a language and into a way that normal people like me could potentially understand. And obviously, if we wanted to delve into it deeper, we could go into the academics. But do you think that's part of the popularity, these people being able to bring it into the normal space?
I think definitely. I think that what we've always strived to do with the Unbelievable show is to take some of that stuff that's often in the ivory towers of academia and try and put it on an everyday person's level. Now, I'll freely admit some shows are more complex and more dense and more intellectually kind of, challenging. I've had shows where I've struggled to keep up a lot of the time because the guests are over here and I'm sort of still back here struggling to keep up. But having said that, overall, I think actually we tend to do a pretty good job on the show of taking that stuff and making it accessible. But I think what's really key, what's different perhaps from us and many other apologetic shows and Christian shows, is that we do genuinely try to put the best of both sides. And that can be challenging. You know, it can be very challenging for someone to hear, you know, someone like Bart M and kind of, you know, digging into the Bible and making all these criticisms. And the responsibility in a sense on my shoulders has been always to try and make sure we've got the best person to speak back on that and to make sure that we get that meeting of both minds. And that was a good example of that, where I thought Peter J. Williams did a wonderful job of saying, well, hang on a minute, Bart, you know, you've got this glass half empty approach. I think it's not quite the same as it when you look at it from this perspective. Because I went into that show thinking Bart had some pretty good arguments, you know, and he does have some good arguments. But again, it's about actually, I suppose that was one show where which was really key for me in helping me to understand the depth of New Testament scholarship and that it's not as simple as just God downloaded this set of documents and, you know, they were just there ready made for us. There is this history of how they came to be and, you know, all of the things that occurred to bring them to the point where we've got this set of documents in a nice leather bound edition on our tables. And that there is a lot of human factors that went into that. But at the same time, I've also been reminded constantly about just how extraordinarily harmonious actually, and the kind of the way in which the Bible still has this unity that exists that sort of goes beyond just a purely human sort of conditions in which it arose. And so for me, I've always found actually that those conversations, they've helped to deepen my admiration for scripture and what it is, even if there are sort of occasionally moments along the way where you think, okay, I'm going to have to revisit some of the maybe my misconceptions about how the Bible came together in the past. So and I think that's probably been true of many people who've listened to these shows over the years, that it's challenged them, stretched them, but ultimately they've been left with a deeper, more mature faith that can kind of cope with some of those critiques that come their way.
Well, Justin, this might be really difficult to do given that there are hundreds and hundreds of episodes to choose from, but what have been some of the most memorable shows as you look back over 17 and a half years of Unbelievable?
That is a tough one, Ruth. There have been so many memorable shows. I think probably, yeah, certainly some of them are with those well-known characters that you often have. But equally, some of them have been just very honest shows with people that you wouldn't necessarily know that well, but who have just come on. And I think it's when you get sometimes beyond just the intellectual arguments to really hearing someone's story and getting a sense of who they are. I can remember back to a show on the problem of suffering that we did with Sharon Dierks, who you and I both know. She's a wonderful Christian thinker and apologist. And she came on with Alom Shaha, who had written at the time, he's an atheist, he'd written something called The Young Atheist Handbook. And I remember that being a great example of Alom being very open-hearted and willing to share his own personal experiences of suffering and the way that had shaped him and how that had, you know, in some ways led to his rejection of God. And although, you know, at one level it was an intellectual engagement, it was also, you know, a genuine meeting of two people having a proper conversation along those lines. And so those are some of, I think, some of the great best shows where you get that real sense of engagement on both sides. Of course, we've had some real kind of memorable shows in the sense of shows that just went viral, that just, you know, lots of people ended up watching or listening because of the individuals involved, because we were capturing a certain cultural zeitgeist or moment. And the one that most obviously springs to mind, you know, is in 2011, when many people were following Rob Bell. He was, you know, this up-and-coming megachurch pastor. His Numa DVDs were best-selling. He was selling a number of books as well. And I remember when I got the manuscript of his latest book in 2011, Love Wins, and I read through it, flicked through it, and I thought, this is going to cause a bit of controversy. Because as I read it, I thought, it sounds a lot like Rob Bell is defending some form of universalism in this book as I read it. So anyway, I invited Rob to come on the show, and I had him on with Adrian Warnock. And this, as you can tell from the clips we've already played, you know, at this point, we still weren't videoing the show on anything like a regular basis. It was really audio only. This one, we did decide to bring some cameras in for. And so you'll be able to watch a bit of this on video. But this is just a little bit of us actually having a discussion on Rob Bell's book at the time, Love Wins, in which Adrian Warnock, my other Christian guest, sort of grilled Rob on whether he was effectively defending some form of universalism that ultimately everyone gets saved. Let's listen to a quick clip of it.
Set aside from the idea of no hope, do you believe that God will create a situation in which repentance no longer is possible or matters?
Well, again, I don't see a single hint in the scriptures of repentance after death. I really don't.
So what God does in God's judgment, God has to create a situation to be true to God's judgment in which there is this for this person. It is fixed. It goes on into the future with no end. And there is no hope, and there is no repentance no longer means anything. And somebody says, God, I am sorry. I am so grieved at my sin. I have so wronged you and violated you. I am so sorry. I understand now that Christ is the way. I understand the cost of the sacrifice, and I am desperate to have a relationship with you. And God, is there a point at which God says, I can't do anything about that. Sorry, your repentance means nothing.
Well, I think you're being too optimistic. I think people in this world, once they've rejected Jesus, what makes you think in the future world they're going to suddenly go, oh, I got it wrong? I mean, go back to the rich man. He does seem to regret some of the consequences, but he doesn't even ask, hey, can I go to heaven now?
The rich man has experienced no sort of
death. Let's just put this in context. We've brought in the concept of...
So there you go. Yeah, that was just a clip. And you can go back and listen to the full show, of course, if you want, of Rob Bell and Adrian Warnock debating universalism, Love Wins at the time. And that was really interesting one, Ruth, because we videoed this interchange as well. And that very quickly got picked up by lots of other media channels. There was lots of interest in Rob Bell at the time, obviously, because of the controversy that this book had sort of elicited in evangelical circles. And so it was interesting, really, just to see the way that really put the show out, you know, to a whole new audience because of this particular moment that we'd captured where he was having to defend his particular thesis in that book.
So, Justin, this might be even more difficult to answer, but what about some of the shows where perhaps they were memorable for maybe the wrong reasons?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, Ruth. That's a very sensitive way of putting it.
I wasn't going to ask, like, who's your least favourite person or anything like that.
I wouldn't want to say that there are any least favourites, but there are definitely some shows that have been more challenging to record. Mm. And to be honest, even that one that we just heard from Rob Bell and Adrian Warnock was sort of kind of awkward at points, you know. Mm. And the funny thing is, in all these years of hosting this show, I'm a fairly conflict averse person, and yet I host a show which basically thrives on the idea of different perspectives and so on. And maybe it's because I like to mediate and sort of find, you know, common ground and so on, that's why it's done well. But I suppose some of the ones which were hardest to moderate are some of the ones that come to mind in terms of the difficult shows. Mm. I mean, remember one, for instance, where and it was my fault in some ways for even attempting to do a show on this, but there was a show many years ago where we were debating whether Muhammad was a historical figure and the historicity of the Quran and so on. And the two guests I had on that really went for each other. Mm. Fortunately, one of them was in the studio and one was on a phone line, so it couldn't get physically aggressive, but it got verbally aggressive on that show. And I remember at one point I had to stop the recording and say, guys, if this carries on, because they were starting to kind of, you know, verbally sort of berate each other, I'm going to have to put a pause and put or call a stop to this. And kind of things cooled down a bit, but, you know, started to ramp up again. Anyway, that was a tough one, I think, for a lot of listeners to listen to be honest. Mm. And I got a lot of feedback on that one. There was another show. I think the one, maybe another one that comes to mind is Jane Ozan, who is a campaigner for LGBT in the Christian side of things, opposite Robert Gagnon, who's very much coming from a conservative Christian perspective. I had them both in studio on that occasion, and it got very tense very quickly in the conversation, and you could have sort of cut the atmosphere with a knife. So there were some really challenging moments, I will say. Perhaps the one that's become best known, though, on the show for the kind of going viral for perhaps the wrong reasons, was when I had Mark Driscoll on the show. Mm-hmm. This was back in early 2012. It was at the time when Mark had written a book called Real Marriage, written by him and his wife, Grace. But it was also in the midst of, as there had been for a couple of years, number of controversies around Mark Driscoll's ministry, things he was saying online, that kind of thing. Obviously, in retrospect now, 10 plus years on, we obviously have a lot more in the back mirror of what happened with Mark Driscoll and Mars Hill and everything else. But this was just an interesting moment in early 2012, because I went in having a conversation with Mark about his ministry, and I put some of these controversies to him across the course of the interview. He said some quite controversial things in response. That later got picked up when it went out in a magazine interview at the time by some, you know, publications, some Christian publications. And, you know, there was, again, some controversy developed out of that. And Mark Driscoll at the time responded on social media saying, oh, well, this came from an interview and there was this guy who was on it. And, you know, he was a bit of a wet blanket, basically. And he was theologically liberal and, you know, and you know, you shouldn't. So saying a number of things. And it turned out I was that guy. Anyway, I thought, well, you know what? The best way of showing people exactly what happened is to put the full audio of this interview out, which I did do. And so we ended up putting the whole Mark Driscoll episode out, which included a bit that I wasn't planning on putting out originally, but because he'd referenced it in his response, it was a sort of bit where we'd sort of finished the proper interview, but he kind of came back and started asking me a few questions because he felt that he'd been sort of grilled a bit. He was going to grill the interviewer. So if you can bear it, Ruth, do you want to hear what happened?
Sure. Yes, I do. Okay.
Well, this was because we got to the point where I'd happened to mention that my wife was a church leader, and that obviously is not a theological position that Mark is keen on. He ended up asking me some questions, and I'll play you what happened at this moment in this conversation.
Let me ask you a few hard questions.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
So in the church that your wife pastors, how many young men have come to Christ in the last year?
Well, we're not a huge church, unlike yours, but I'd say there's two or three probably in the last year who certainly, I'd say kind of have come to Christ in, yeah, a pretty meaningful way.
Okay, and in the church, what percentage is young men, single men?
It's difficult to say off the top of my head, but I'd freely say it's certainly not a big percentage, no.
Okay, and are you okay with that? Do you think that's the best way to go?
No, but can it be so easily put down to the fact that the church is being run by a woman? I mean, is that...
Yep. You look at your results, you look at my results, and you look at the variable that's most obvious.
Well, in our case, the...
Up
to the point my wife took over, it had been run by men. Since she's come, lots of new families, lots of younger people, both men and women have come. I wouldn't say the balance is right, perfect yet by any means, but it's certainly a lot better than it ever was. And so I don't necessarily see quite the same situation that you paint there in terms of men not relating. I've seen more men in the church since she's been there than before she was there, in a way.
What kind of men? Strong men?
Well, men. I mean, men come in different shapes and sizes. I mean, yeah, both really. Men who are very masculine, men who are I guess on a spectrum more effeminate, but I couldn't say that there's been a sort of dearth of men in the church since she's arrived. I mean, Mark, I didn't want to get into a sort of argument.
No,
about
you don't
this.
Want to sit in my seat. I understand.
So there you go. That was the part of our conversation. As you can tell, I was being this terribly different sort of Englishman to Mark's sort of, you know, slightly more bullish. Approach, but it was just very memorable, perhaps for the wrong reasons. I wasn't even intending for that bit to go out, but because he talked about it on the social media, I thought, look, we've got it on tape. We might as well put out exactly what happened in this conversation. And if anyone wants to put themselves through listening to it, it is back there in the archives of Unbelievable.
Well, this feels like an appropriate place to take a break, but don't go anywhere because we will be back with much more.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight, and it's made possible through the support of listeners like you. And your support today is so vital, we want to thank you for your generous gift by giving you exclusive access to Science, Faith and the Evidence for God Apologetics course. This 9-module course invites you to learn from John Lennox, one of the most celebrated Christian thinkers of our time, through conversations with atheist thinker Michael Ruse and secular talk show host Dave Rubin. You'll be empowered to confidently speak into conversations on faith, science, and why believing in God is not only reasonable, but logical. The course is free to you to thank you for your gift to help Premier Insight equip more Christians to confidently speak into the biggest issues of our culture and defend their Christian faith with conviction and grace. To get access to Science, Faith, and the Evidence for God, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Unbelievable show. Thank you for your support. Later.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to a slightly different version of Unbelievable, where we're having a look back at the last 17 and a half years of Unbelievable. And one of the things that I guess was a significant moment in the life of Unbelievable was the conference, which started in 2011. And that was also the year of the Reasonable Faith Tour with William Lane Craig. Justin, what are some of your memories of that time?
It was a really significant year, 2011. It was also the year that Rob Bell video went viral. So there were lots of things happening that year. But yeah, one of them was also that we launched our first Unbelievable conference, which was wonderful. And so we had a day in which we had lots of Christian thinkers come to share. And it was great to meet physically with people who were listeners of Unbelievable. And that was wonderful. But yeah, one of the abiding memories of 2011 is the Reasonable Faith Tour. William Lane Craig, of course, has been a regular guest on the show over the years, both debating other people, atheists, skeptics, other Christians from different perspectives. He came on the show just recently to answer a whole load of listener questions on a show. But this was a special time when he came over to the UK to embark on a series of lectures and debates across the country, starting in London. And I was hosting the London leg of the Reasonable Faith Tour. And he was due to encounter Stephen Law, who's an atheist philosopher. So shall we have a little listen to some of what happened when they debated the existence of God in front of 1,700 people at Westminster Central Hall?
I mean, what so often happens in these debates is that people, atheists, allow themselves to be sucked into detailed conversations about exactly what's wrong with the cosmological argument and lose sight of the larger structure of the argument, such as the fact that even if it were true that there is some sort of creator, there is nevertheless abundant evidence that it's not an all-powerful, all-good God. And so there, it's in a way you can create, and I'm not accusing you of this, Bill, but it is possible to create a kind of smokescreen, immunizing smokescreen around your belief by conjuring up questions about exactly what's wrong with the cosmological argument and then distract people's attention away from the elephant in the corner of the room, which is, even if you could show that there was some sort of creator, it ain't that one.
Pardon me? even if you push your wife.
It's not your one. It's not that
it,
one.
It's not the good God if there is a creator.
In the same way that we can be absolute.
It's part of a cumulative case.
But it makes there's no cumulative case at all so far as showing that it's, say, good rather than evil. And the challenge
let me put, this question comes up. A lot of people asking a similar question. Why not, and this could apply to both of you, argue that God is simply neutral? Does she or he have to be good or evil? So Stephen appears to be saying here, Bill, even if I granted you the cosmological argument, and we haven't heard his full objections to that yet, but even if I did, why assume it good rather than evil?
That's my moral argument.
Okay,
see,
just
I'm
explain that again.
Of this, and so I offer a cumulative case where the first argument gives us a personal creator of the universe. Often I'll use a fine-tuning argument to give us a designer of the universe, a moral argument to give us some of his moral properties. And so you build a theologically rich concept of God through all of these various arguments. And this is the project of natural theology. This is the way it works. You build a cumulative case for the existence of God.
So that was Bill Craig and Stephen Law debating the existence of God. And it was just, it was wonderful to be able to host that opening leg of the Reasonable Faith Tour. Bill went on to debate other people in other parts of the country, to give lectures in Cambridge and Oxford. The funny part, the thing that was most memorable about this, Ruth, was that our mutual friend and colleague Peter Byram was involved in this tour. Peter Byram, up to that point, had been an agnostic, and it was on this tour that he made the decision to become a Christian. So that, for me, has a special resonance and meaningfulness, because we've both worked now with Peter Byram for a couple of years as the administrator on All Things Unbelievable. He was also very influential in us doing a little tongue-in-cheek campaign, advertising campaign at the time. This was not that long after that Atheist Bus campaign, which said, there's probably no God, now stop worrying and enjoy your life. Well, we were inviting at the time Richard Dawkins, you know, the biggest atheist in the world, to come and debate William Lane Craig on his home turf in Oxford. He had declined for various reasons. And so we very cheekily set up a little bus campaign around Oxford saying, there's probably no Richard Dawkins, but come along to the Sheldonian Theatre and find out, because we kind of left this empty chair symbolically for him to take up if he wanted to. Anyway, there was a lot of fun, a lot of memories. It was a very significant time for all kinds of reasons. And so that's definitely a big highlight from all the years of Unbelievable.
So I guess sort of fast forward a few years on from there. In 2016, you started writing this book here, Unbelievable, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, which was obviously published the following year in 2017. I mean, I guess, what was it that prompted you to write this book? Because obviously you'd been having those conversations for 10 years. So what was it about being 10 years into the show that made you think, right, now's the time to get some of this stuff on paper?
I think the reason that I did the book at the 10-year mark is simply that by that time I felt I'd learned enough myself to be able to put some of this to paper. I think having heard so many of the arguments for and against Christianity up to that point, I'd sort of managed to cipher and decide on which ones were, for me, the most compelling arguments for God and for Christianity. What, if you like, you really needed as a basis for believing, and what were kind of more secondary issues that you can kind of live without, if you like. And so that was really what I was attempting to do, and to do it, hopefully, in a way, as we said earlier, which brought some of these arguments out of the ivory tower and put them into the layperson's lap. And I tried to do that by simply talking about the show, sharing anecdotes, stories from the show, in hopefully relatable ways that made the case for faith. And so it really marked a change, I suppose, in as much as up to that point, I'd become known as the moderator of this show, essentially the person who hosted the discussions. This was the time when I took off my neutral moderator's cap and actually said, I'm going to make a case for faith now. And that led, actually, in the end, to me doing a lot more speaking in churches and events on the case for Christianity, and sometimes sitting in the protagonist chair in debates rather than always in the neutral moderator's chair.
I mean, I guess, like, you've written a whole book on it, so this is going to be really hard to whittle down. But if you could whittle it down to, like, one point or one sentence, why do you still believe in God after well, more than 10 years now of listening to atheists.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, maybe there'll be an update. Why I'm still a Christian after 20 years of talking about it. But, well, I think if it were down to sort of just one thought, it would simply be that, for me, Christianity remains the most compelling explanation of reality that I've ever encountered. Because in the book, I essentially look at other versions of reality, other explanations of how we're here, why we're here, what life is about. And I just find them lacking. I've never been ultimately convinced by the atheist perspective. I have lots of atheist friends, enormous respect for atheists and the positions they take. But in the end, I've just find the Christian story the most compelling vision of reality. I find it historically, it makes sense. I find that philosophically it makes sense. I find that emotionally it makes sense of us as well. So there are all kinds of different ways in which I think, for me, it makes sense to be a Christian. And that was ultimately where I landed on that book.
Do you mind if I just ask something that's kind of the flip reverse of that? You mentioned at the Bart book, when you read it, you were like, oh, flip, there's quite a lot of good stuff in here. Do you think there's one argument, one objection that you've come across through the shows where you think, oh, wow, that is probably the biggest challenge to my faith? That's the thing that makes me most want to doubt my faith.
I think it's always going to be some version of the problem of evil, because I think that's the one that you most frequently come up against. It's the one which is not simply an intellectual problem. Mm. It's an emotional problem. And for me, that's always been the toughest one, because when you're confronted with someone who has actually experienced great suffering, you know, there is sometimes a place for an intellectual argument, but very often that will fall flat.
Yeah.
If you try and simply crowbar that into a conversation. And so for me, that probably remains the most difficult one. I did try to attempt, you know, an answer to that issue in one chapter of that book, but inevitably your answers will always be limited in that particular area. And so I just think it's one where you have to have a great deal of humility. You have to make sure that you're meeting someone where they are, rather than just, as I say, on that intellectual level, and that you just, yeah, treat it very carefully, because ultimately we don't have all the answers. There is a great mystery to suffering, and it's not something that can just be, you know, eradicated with a clever syllogism or argument. So yeah, for me, I suppose it's perhaps the most obvious one, but it would still be the problem of evil and suffering.
Yeah, well, I guess there's a reason it's the most obvious one, because it's probably the most universal question. Well, let's fast forward a few more years again. In 2018, The Big Conversation was launched, and so was around that time as well the Unbelievable YouTube channel. Now, what was The Big Conversation, and who were some of the people that appeared on The Big Conversation? Because that was quite a big thing, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So we were fortunate to receive some funding, some grant funding from the Templeton Foundation to start a new video series called The Big Conversation from Unbelievable, in which we would hopefully bring together some of the biggest thinkers across the atheist and Christian world and talk about some of the biggest questions and topics that are out there. And that's what we aim to do. And we began it in 2018. It gave us the ability to launch effectively our YouTube channel properly. And we started with a bang, because I managed to get hold of this, at the time, relatively unknown psychology professor called Jordan Peterson to come on the show while he was over promoting a book that hadn't yet been released, called 12 Rules for Life, and get him in conversation with a well-known atheist called Susan Blackmore, who's a psychologist herself. And of course, you know, what turned out to be just Peterson was just about to go stellar, basically. In fact, just a couple of days after I recorded my big conversation between him and Susan, he went and had this viral news interview with Kathy Newman on Channel 4, and suddenly everyone was talking about Jordan Peterson, and I was sitting on this, like, you know, amazing debate that I wasn't going to release for a few more months. But once we did release it, yeah, it was extremely popular, and really put a rocket under our new fledgling YouTube channel. So that was our first big conversation, and the start of some fantastic episodes in 2018, where we featured people like Derren Brown and Reverend Richard Coles, Steven Pinker opposite Nick Spencer, Daniel Dennett and Keith Ward. So many, you know, fantastic, interesting debates that I was privileged to moderate during that first season of The Big Conversation. But it all started, yes, with Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore.
Yeah, which that's now got 3.5 million views, I think, and like 25,000 comments or something on that YouTube clip. So it's obviously continues to be very popular.
Yeah. Should we hear a little clip from
it? Yeah, why
not? To remind those who perhaps, the very small number of people who haven't actually watched or listened to that episode. Here's a little bit of Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore debating whether secular culture is living on the corpse of the Christian West.
Let me go back to that point. We know that more dysfunctional societies have higher proclaimed belief, higher attendance in church, and so on. Now, this doesn't fit with what you were saying. Now, Nietzsche's ideas are very profound and interesting, but I just want to stop you from saying that he was absolutely right about somehow if we get rid of God, we're going to be worse, because we have very well-functioning societies
in Scandinavia, for example, we were pretty bad in the 20th century.
Oh, we were, yes. People were.
And we could easily drift that way again.
And there have been terrible bad things done in the name of God, and there have been terrible bad things done in the name of communism and atheism. I don't think we can weigh them up, and you'll say no problem, but then you have to go against this evidence that I've just stated.
Jordan, come back on this evidence. I mean, obviously from her perspective, Sue feels like actually we've got pretty stable societies that are increasingly secular these days, so perhaps Nietzsche was wrong, and in fact we're not going to see this moral,
well, I would say
decay.
they're stable to the degree that they're actually not secular. And this is also a Nietzschean observation, and a Dostoevskian observation for that matter, is that we're living on the corpse of our ancestors like we always have. That's a very old idea. Mm. But that stops being nourishing and starts to become rotten unless you replenish it. And I don't think we are replenishing it. We're living on borrowed time and in danger of running out of it. I think that the reason that the Western societies essentially work quite well is because they act out a Judeo-Christian ethic, and one that's essentially predicated on utmost regard for the sovereignty of the individual. So the individual is sovereign in relationship to the state, which is a remarkable idea, and one that's fundamentally religious in its essence, in my mode of thinking, and that's also predicated on honest speech. And there's other predicates at all as well, but those are religious predicates in my estimation.
Well, what a show. And you can check out the whole show on our YouTube channel or bigconversation.show. But 2018 was a big year, really, wasn't it? Because it also saw the first overseas conference for Unbelievable in Portland, Oregon, and also the launch of the Ask NT Write Anything podcast. So big year. Tell us about those two things, Justin.
Yeah, again, this was interesting because we'd obviously established this international audience for some time through Unbelievable, lots of people in the US, in Canada, listening to the show. So it was joyful to be able to go over in 2018 and host the first of our Unbelievable conferences overseas. So this was in Portland, Oregon, at West Side of Jesus Church at the time. Dominic, a friend of mine out there, was the pastor of the church. And it was lovely to see hundreds of people turning out who listened to Unbelievable. I think Portland, Oregon, I've been told, is one of the most secular cities in the USA. It's certainly not part of the Bible Belt. And so I think there was a special affinity for what we were doing with Unbelievable there, bringing these kinds of conversations together. But also, the launch of what has become our other most popular podcast from Premier, the Ask NT Write Anything podcast. And this was because I'd featured NT Wright, well-known New Testament scholar, on the Unbelievable show several times over the years, either in discussions or for interviews about his latest books, his work on Paul, etc. And really the genesis for having a regular show with Tom really started when I brought him into studio to have a conversation with Tom Holland, not the Spider-Man Tom Holland, the historian Tom Holland, who, of course, at the time hadn't published but was working on his magnum opus, his book Dominion, and the way in which he was finding that the Christian story, the Christian revolution, had shaped the West in so many ways. And I knew that Tom was interested in Tom Wright's ideas and vice versa. So I thought, why don't we bring these two together for a conversation? Because Tom Wright had recently published his biography of Paul, which was a fantastic read. And I knew that Tom Holland had read it and endorsed it. So I brought them together into studio and they just got on like a house on fire. It was like, you know, I could barely get a word in edgeways because they were just, you know, having a high old time talking to each other about the historicity of Christianity, about the effect of the Apostle Paul and Jesus on history and so on. So let's just hear a little bit of their conversation on and the video that we captured.
I think essentially what Paul's significance is that he sets up ripple effects of revolution throughout Western history. Mm. So the 11th century, where with the papal revolution, essentially it establishes this idea that society has to be reborn, reconfigured, that vested interests have to be torn down. And then the Reformation, what we call the Reformation, is a further ripple effect of that. And the Enlightenment is a further ripple effect of that. And, it's spilled out so much that now in the 21st century, we don't even realize where these ripple effects are coming from. We just take them for granted.
I can hear Tom Wright, you want to come in and...
Well, I was just thinking, I haven't actually read from cover to cover, but Stephen Pinker's two books where he's saying effectively...
Well, I had him on the show quite recently.
Oh, really?
Yes,
okay.
He's
saying, forget all that religion stuff. We invented the real world as it should be in the Enlightenment, and all we have to do is apply that more and more rigorously and just kick that religion stuff into touch. And it's very interesting that some commentators have said, well, if that was going to be the case, it would work in America better than anywhere else. And look at America and what's actually happening, and you'll see that it doesn't. But I think I want to respond with what Pope Benedict said 10 years ago when he was speaking at the United Nations, when he said that the whole idea of human rights is absolutely rooted in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And if you try and get the fruits of that without the roots, all you'll get is the thing will collapse into shrill special interest rhetoric, everyone claiming the status of victim and
now,
shouting
when
at
I
himself,
had
which
Stephen,
is exactly
Stephen,
what we
of course, but the power of victimhood
is
again something that is part of the revolutionary inheritance of Christianity.
Yes.
Because that is the point.
There you go. You get the idea. It was just, they were just having a great time. And I just enjoyed sitting
switch
back
your microphone
and
off. Letting...
Yeah, exactly. And it's sometimes like that with some shows, I just don't want to actually get in the way sometimes of the great conversations that are being had. And of course, it was on that day, actually, that I suggested to Tom, hey, have you thought about maybe just doing a regular podcast where people could just send in questions and we could just read them out and you could answer? And so later in the year, we launched that towards the end of 2018. And that's been fantastic to see the way that has ministered to so many people all over the world, the Ask Anti-Right Anything podcast.
I mean, do you think part of the popularity is that he's got the best voice ever? It's like Aslan answering questions, isn't it?
I mean, Tom Wright is just, he has the whole package. Look, he's just incredibly clever, but he can take that really academic mind and put it in really helpful, easily engageable writing and speaking. I mean, sometimes I've phoned Tom up for like, can you give me a 1 minute thought on this, Tom? And he'll just give you it like that. He's incredible. But he's also just the most gentle, humble guy as well, and got such a wonderful pastoral heart. So yeah, big fan of NT Wright over here.
Well, once you've finished loving on Tom Wright, which we all do, obviously, but moving on a few more years, in 2019, the Unbelievable Conference came to California, and there was an equally kind of brilliant onstage conversation between John Lennox and Dave Rubin. Would you just say a little bit about how that came about? Because that was a lovely conversation as well, wasn't it?
It was. And if NT Wright is one of my favourite sort of mentors that have been on the show over the years, John Lennox has to be an equal sort of force, because he's just, as you know, Ruth, just one of the most wonderful people. Such a warm, personable Irishman, but also with this great mind and just a real love for God. And what I loved about bringing him on stage in California with Dave Rubin, who's popular talk show host, has his own thriving YouTube channel, was that they just had this most open-handed, generous conversation. Dave Rubin is a sort of secular Jewish person by background, and at one time would have happily described himself as an atheist. But on this sort of conversation, I think probably he was more explicit than it had ever been before, that he no longer identified as an atheist, actually, and the journey he'd been on. And again, in front of lots of people who were there at Calvary Chapel, Costa Mesa, where we were doing this. And you were there as well, Ruth, of course, weren't you? Because this was part of our California conference that you came out for as well. They just had this really generous, open-handed conversation, and the audience absolutely loved it, as did I. So, yeah, this was one of my most memorable sort of live events that I staged. So I thought we'd maybe play a little clip from this one as well. Is that all right?
Go on, then.
I think for me, the adventure of discussing this and seeing what kind of people that I bring into my studio, that I interact with at events like this, what type of people I want to be around, that really is the proof. Mm-hmm. That is what, well, that's what makes this, right? That's what makes this. So I don't know. So I get the question, I respect the question truly. And it's the question, right? Yeah. I mean, it's like saying, what's the meaning of life, right? It's the big one. I would say I'm on the adventure to finding that out. And I'm really okay with that. You know, I hope that doesn't sound, dismissive of the question or like I'm trying to evade it. I'm really not. I like and maybe this is just a function also of what I do for a living. I mean, I get to sit every week with people that in most cases are smarter than me, who have spent years working through all of these issues, as you have, John. And that is an incredible privilege that I have. So I would like to see how far I can take that.
Sounds like we're not going to convert him tonight.
You're doing your best.
Yeah. Working overtime over there, I'll tell you that much.
But it's wonderful to hear an open description of a journey. And I try to think my way into this, that getting around these ideas is really big stuff. I mean, coming the way you've moved, from the little I've understood of it, just meeting you for the first time, is most interesting to me, the way that movement is going. Now, from where I sit, there's another element comes into it. What I mean by that is this. There's the things that we can think about existentially, as you're doing, and that's vastly important to me as well, the kind of people you like to be with, the evidence of that, you like this, if you feel there's something outside yourself, and so on and so forth. But then it comes to a couple of questions. One is, could it be that something is actually personal?
Well, again, what an example of an incredibly humble man, John Lennox and Dave Rubin. An amazing conversation there. And then we kind of, if we fast forward a little bit, we get to the COVID pandemic, which was obviously a huge shift for everyone in some senses in 2020. But it necessitated a big shift for the Unbelievable show. You ended up in your home studio where you are now. So what did 2020 look like for Unbelievable?
Well, like for everyone, it was a complete change. We had to pivot very quickly to recording from home, and everything changed, you know, so quickly. But obviously, it was also about responding to what was going on in the world at that time. You couldn't just keep having, you know, God debates and ignoring this kind of global pandemic that was going on around us. So a lot of the conversations obviously switched to that. We talked about that. We talked through it. We had a lot of those kinds of discussions and debates. And obviously, 2020 itself, there were all kinds of other issues that then came into view, including the George Floyd killing. And so we had debates around that and Black Lives Matter and so on. So it was a significant year in so many ways. Of course, you know, we carried on, and actually the show only, you know, continued to grow in strength. I think more people were able to watch online because of kind of being locked in their homes in that way. So we saw a lot of growth in our YouTube channel. And it was great to be able to continue producing things like The Big Conversation and to see that go from strength to strength as well. Because it was really during that time of lockdown recording that we were able to have some great episodes between people like Bishop Robert Barron and Cosmic Skeptic Alex O'Connor that were fantastic. And of course, Richard Dawkins, who came on the show in 2021 opposite Francis Collins, who's a well-known Christian geneticist. And I was just super pleased when Richard Dawkins said yes to this one, because I'd been wanting to have Richard Dawkins on for a really proper discussion for a long time. And this was our chance.
Yeah, because that wasn't the first time that he'd appeared on the show, was it? But it was the first time he was like really talking about his area of expertise, wasn't it? How did that come
exactly
about?
Yeah, so previously I'd had a very brief conversation at an event with John Lennox, funnily enough, with Richard Dawkins, that had featured on a show several years before. And then he'd come on to talk about the Old Testament, but he's a scientist, not a theologian. So this was him coming on to talk about science and God with Francis Collins. And I've got to admit, I didn't think he'd get back to my email when I sent him one saying, would you there be any interest in you coming on my show to talk with Francis Collins? He's a busy man, Richard Dawkins, and, you know, in the past, at least, I haven't sensed that he's been very open to kind of having those kinds of debates, really, in that kind of format with, you know, really intelligent Christian thinkers like him. But he surprised me. He came back quite quickly and said, actually, I respect Francis Collins a great deal. Mm. So I would like to take up this invitation. And the reason I think he said yes was because it wasn't just that Francis Collins was his intellectual equal when it came to science, you know, a well-known geneticist, though Richard Dawkins did ask a few technical questions that he wanted answers to on that front. But it was also one moment in the show where I realised there was a great deal of respect for Francis because of the generosity and kindness he'd shown to their mutual friend Christopher Hitchens, right, who, of course, was another one of the four horsemen of the New Atheism. And at about the time when Christopher Hitchens was diagnosed with esophageal cancer, Francis Collins had used his medical background and training in genetics to extend his life. So shall we just listen to a little clip of Francis telling that story and Richard Dawkins' reaction?
We became friends, and I would go and drop by his apartment, and we would drink wine, and he would drink scotch, and we would discuss everything from faith to George Orwell to Thomas Jefferson to whatever else was on his mind. An incredible mind he had. And then he got sick, and he was suddenly diagnosed with already very advanced esophageal cancer. And I was glad to try to help to see if there was something that could buy some time. And I think we did buy him some time, actually, with some genomic analysis of his cancer to figure out what would be the most effective therapy. And perhaps he was with us for an extra 6 or 9 months. And I was quite close to him during that time. He never wavered, unless anyone say otherwise, and his atheism. But he was a gracious friend to me. And I think we both enjoyed that experience, even though we disagreed rather deeply on life's most important question, is there a God?
Any thoughts on that as well from yourself, Richard? I know that Hitchens, in a sense, were quite interesting in that way. He really did actually genuinely have friends across the aisle, despite his, you know, strongly held positions himself.
I was aware, Francis, of what you were doing for him, and on behalf of people, as it were, on my side of the aisle, we felt really grateful to you for what you were doing.
Brilliant conversation there between Francis Collins and Richard Dawkins, which I think kind of epitomises some of what we've been trying to do on The Big Conversation. We're going to take a short break, but don't go anywhere because we will be back soon.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. And as you'll hear in a moment, it's a significant one for me. And there is a reason why we've been travelling back over 17 years of broadcast history from The Unbelievable Show from 2005 up to 2023. But we haven't quite got to the end of the story, have we, Ruth? There's a little bit more to add.
Yeah, so why don't you just fill us in then from 2021, where we had some of those amazing episodes of The Big Conversation, but there was a lot more happening in 2021 and 2022. We saw the launch of some new podcasts and video shows. Why don't you tell us about some of those things? And I guess tied in with all of that was the launch of the Premier Unbelievable Department website. What was the vision behind some of that, and what are some of those shows, Justin?
I mean, you were pretty busy at that time too, Ruth, having a baby, let's not forget. That was a significant moment in the life of the show.
Well, and the thing is, I left to have a baby and I came back and all of this stuff had happened. There was like podcasts
it's true.
Everywhere.
We got rid of Ruth for a year and then suddenly everything had changed by the time she came back. No, it was actually around, I think, probably 2021 that we started really taking seriously the idea of kind of doing what we'd already started to do. We'd started to create new shows like the Ask Anti Write Anything podcast. We were publishing articles. We had The Big Conversation going. We thought, you know, we need an umbrella for all this activity. And so we decided simply to call that umbrella Premier Unbelievable, the kind of one-stop shop for theology and apologetics. Mm-hmm. So in sort of May 2022, it would have been just under a year ago, that we officially launched Premier Unbelievable as a new website, premierunbelievable.com. We brought on board John and Tim Wyatt with the Matters of Life and Death podcast. So that's all about bioethics and those big issues and questions around ethics and so on from a Christian perspective. We started the Unapologetic podcast, which you now, of course, run, Ruth, which are these bite-sized conversations with Christian thinkers and evangelists and theologians. And, of course, you had started the year before the C.S. Lewis podcast with Alistair McGrath, which is a wonderful dive into the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis. So all of these came under the banner of Premier Unbelievable and, of course, tons of articles, which you're responsible for the majority of, Ruth. And that's where we've come up to. As of today, we've got a wonderful, thriving apologetics and theology department. And here we are, 17 and a half years later. I could not have predicted how it would all come together, but that's where we are.
Well, so I guess we kind of asked at the beginning, you know, why it started and all of that. And there's been sort of reflections as we've been going on. But it feels like an obvious question as we've had a look at a kind of potted history, 17 and a half years. What are some of the key things do you think you've learned over this time? And I guess, is there anything that you've massively changed your thinking about, Justin, over those years?
Oh, my goodness. There's definitely been some things I've changed my thinking on. You know, there's certain doctrinal issues where maybe I take a more sort of a more nuanced approach to certain issues than I did before. But without like diving into any of the specifics, I'd say the big thing is that I've come to realize just how intellectually robust Christianity is. And for me, it's just been an education. I mean, an education I couldn't have wished for a better education, really, in theology and apologetics, and hosting a show where you get to sit down with some of the brightest minds on both sides of the aisle for all of those years. And it's made me aware of my limitations and the need for humility, and that actually, when we have these conversations, we need to be willing to listen and to change our minds sometimes ourselves, and to have that generosity of spirit when we engage people, but also being able to stand in the confidence actually of the Christian faith, that actually it is something which is an emotional, a heartfelt experience, but which also involves the mind, where actually when those two come together, it's an extraordinarily powerful thing. And I've seen that in my life, in the lives of many other people. So I am constantly encouraged actually that despite often, you know, the issues that we see in the church in the West, you know, decline of church going, sometimes, you know, ministry scandals and everything else. Actually, I think ultimately we have been gifted something incredibly precious, and something which actually is vibrant and alive, and actually that we can take forward in confidence, not a kind of, you know, the sort of confidence which dismisses other people, but where we engage people and we have genuine conversations. And I hope that we can continue doing that on Unbelievable for a long time to come.
Well, Justin, we're not just doing this show just so that you can have a look at some of your most kind of fun and awkward moments. There is actually a reason. When we did say at the beginning, and it feels like quite a long time ago now, that we said that there is a reason that these things would become apparent. So, Justin, you've got some news to share. Do you want to use this opportunity now to share what's going on?
Yes, the long-awaited news, which I've been teasing the podcast audience for the last 4 weeks or so. I am moving on from the Unbelievable show. After 17 and a half years of hosting the show, I am going to be moving on to some fresh projects and new places, and still working very much in the area of cultural apologetics. I've got a book that's going to be published later in the year, which I'm really looking forward to doing some speaking and work around. But yes, it will be a very fond farewell to the Unbelievable show from me. I'm so glad for the legacy of all the material that is there in the archive and all that will continue to be broadcast from the show, because we're looking forward to more great shows. I know some of the content that's already lined up includes the next big conversation episode, but there's going to be lots more from the show, and lots to look forward to as people download or watch on the video channel going forward. But for me, it will be a very fond farewell, and sort of over to you, Ruth, and over to Vince Vitale as well, as one of our upcoming guest presenters on the show. So Vince, hello, welcome along to the show.
Oh, hi guys, thanks for having me. It's been such a joy to hear you guys reflecting on the last 17 years. You did have me sweating when you talked about the most challenging and awkward episodes. I thought that if this is me, I'm going to make a quick exit. But that was a real joy. And yeah, we just honor you, Justin, and celebrate all that's been done. It's a real joy, and feel the privilege as well of taking this forward in some part.
Yeah, well, we're so pleased that Vince, you along with a few others, will be sort of guest presenting some future editions of the show. And I feel a little bit like I'm handing over my child to you, though it is a 17-year-old child at this point, Vince.
You see, with my 2-year-old, that's all the experience that I have, 2 and 4-year-olds, so I can't help with teenagers.
Well, just to give a little bit of context of Vince. Vince, you're a Christian thinker, an apologist. You yourself moved from atheism to Christianity just a few years before the launch of Unbelievable. And we're going to be talking some more about that on Unapologetic. So that's definitely a place to go if you want to hear a bit more of Vince's story. But do you want to just give us like a little bit of a potted history of your story, Vince?
Sure. I came to Christian faith 23 years ago. I was a freshman at Princeton at the time. I'm not sure that I was ever an atheist per se, but I was definitely a skeptic. Mm-hmm. And teammates of mine challenged me to read the Bible for the first time. And in this old Bible, I would write BS in the margins wherever I disagreed with what I was reading. For Bible study, of course. and that was sort of my starting point. And in some ways, I would have been an easy person to dismiss and to give up on. But in some ways, I feel like I found a community that is similar to Unbelievable, what the show has tried to do, and the community that's been built around it in significant ways. I found some people that took my questions very seriously, did not dismiss them, took my perspective seriously. And I was shown both the rationality of the Christian faith, but I think without me realizing it along the way, I also began to be able to imagine myself continuing this journey in the context of Christian community and the church. So much more to say in terms of my story. I wound up coming to faith. Not everyone has a specific moment. I sort of do. I was in my dorm room, 122 Jolene Hall. Maybe just one more detail about my story, because I learned this more recently, and it was a huge encouragement to me. I was speaking somewhere, and a woman came forward at the end, and she said, "Did you say 122 Jolene Hall?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "Well, I was at Princeton about 15 years before you, and I lived in 121 Jolene Hall." And she was quite emotional in her face, and she said, "I spent my 4 years in college praying for the salvation of the guys in 122 Jolene Hall."
Wow.
So there's much more to say about my story, even much more than I knew not that long ago. So gracious of God that 15 years before I even thought to turn my attention toward him, he had a woman next door praying for the very floor on which I dropped to my knees and gave my life to him.
Wow, what a story. Vince, you've been on the show yourself one or two times over the years. I remember great discussion between you and Julian Baggini in our studio several years ago when you had published a book on evil. I mean, that's been a specific area of expertise for you. You know, I think your doctorate and so on has been involved in looking at the problem of suffering and evil. Do you want to just very briefly sketch out sort of what you've been doing in that area over the last several years?
Sure, Justin. I appreciate what you said, you know, earlier about the difficulty of the challenge, and also that it's an emotional challenge, not just a philosophical one. The very first conversation I ever had on the topic after I had come to faith was with my Aunt Regina, and she spoke to me about some quite personal suffering in her life and in the life of her son, my cousin. And in response, I was sort of overeager and began spouting some of my philosophical ideas. And she listened very patiently, and then she turned to me and she said, "But Vince, that doesn't speak to me as a mother." Mm. And in some ways, I feel like I can trace then a decade of study on the topic back to that conversation. I want to take this seriously. I don't want to be quick to give answers. I want to be quick to listen and to think in a serious way about this, in a way that can connect with people who are going through real suffering and not just thinking about it abstractly and analytically. So that was a significant portion of my life spent researching into that topic. I did publish a book called Non-Identity Theodicy, a Grace-Based Response to the Problem of Evil. It'll take a while to talk through what's in that book. But the very basic idea is that sometimes when we think about suffering, we picture ourselves in this world and all of its suffering. And understandably, we wish that we were in a very different world with far less suffering or no suffering. And we say, God, why didn't you make me in that very different world? Mm-hmm. We tend not to ask the question, would it still be me and you and all the people whom we love in that very different world that we think we wish God had allowed to exist? And it might be the case that when we think that way, we're unwittingly wishing ourselves and our loved ones out of existence. And could it be the case that one of the reasons, not the only reason, but one of the reasons why God might allow a world like this to exist is because it's a world that allows for you and for me and the people we love and all of the individuals throughout the world to come to exist. Not because they're better or more impressive than other creatures that God could have created. This is the grace focus of the approach, but simply because God found himself with a love for each of those individuals. So that's the very basic idea.
Yeah. I found your writing in this area really helpful, Vince. And I remember one particular thing you said on that show that you did with us about it some time ago that was always stuck with me is you made this analogy, and I know you've made it elsewhere, about the fact that we as parents, if you're a parent, you bring children into the world and you do it fully knowing that they will experience suffering and evil and ultimately death. And yet we do it. And why would we do that? Well, it's because we want to give them the opportunity to experience love and all the good things that life involves, even knowing that they'll experience. And I just found that analogy to why God would bring us into the world really helpful. Now, it doesn't explain everything in this issue, but I've personally found that idea of really getting to the idea of God as a loving father, a loving parent, and kind of you I found that just a helpful way into that whole problem myself.
That encourages me, and I think that would have been much more relevant to my Aunt Regina, for example, than some of the things that I said initially. It's interesting that we bring children into the world, and unlike God, we can't bring into existence a very specific person. We just bring into the world a child and accept who we get, and we also can't guarantee that we can offer each person eternal life. At the end of life, God can make that offer that we're not in position to make. So it's an interesting analogy to think through. If we believe it's okay, and not only okay, but sometimes a courageous thing, as you did with Ruth's child, to celebrate that we bring a child into this world, could it also be the case that there's something loving about God bringing us into the world that we live in?
So you're going to have a chance to sit in the moderator seat for some discussions going forward, Vince. Are you looking forward to it?
Yes, I am, very much, very much. Maybe I'll have a go and turn it around a little bit on you, if that's all right, Justin, for a few questions.
Yes, at the end of, have a practice now.
Have Absolutely. A practice, you know, get a little feedback before we get going here. But I was just thinking, you know, it'd be worth just reflecting a bit on how culture has changed and evolved over that 17 and a half years, you know, and as you said, Ruth, you know, my Christian life, my Christian faith, 23 years, it mirrors to some extent the life of Unbelievable. And I was just thinking about how when I was coming to faith, I was sort of happy as I was, but people were challenging me and I was saying, okay, well, show me it's true. If it is true, then we'll talk implication, application, relevance for my life. And I was asking questions like, does God exist? Is the Bible reliable? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? And in some ways, those questions are still so important, and we get to them eventually, but they're not always the starting point. I remember recently talking with a clinical therapist who's a friend of mine, and I said, if you had to switch out the words happy as I am for words for today, based on what you see in your practice, what would you say? And he just instinctively, immediately said, the mistrustful, brokenhearted. And I was thinking about a youth event that we did not long ago where the first several questions were about suicide, pornography, abuse, and abortion. I think those were literally the first four questions. And I thought, wow, these are so personal, so vulnerable, coming from a place of hurt, and at least in my case, so different from the questions I was asking and the starting point, at least in my journey to faith. So, you know, just one thing I've been reflecting on is how encouraging it's been that Unbelievable has grown more popular and reached more people, even as culture has changed quite significantly. Yeah. And maybe you could just reflect on that, how you've seen it change and then how the show has changed along with it.
I think, in a sense, the little tour we've had through the last 17 years has probably shown a little bit of how it has changed, because the show very much came hot on the heels of the zenith, really, of the New Atheism. I mean, I think just a few months after we started the show, Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, was published. And so for several years, we were kind of following that trend of that very more dogmatic form of anti-theism, answering some of those questions and having those classic God debates, I would say. And that was great, because I think the church needed at that time to kind of be put on its intellectual feet and to have a good response to these fundamental questions about whether there is evidence for God. How do you respond to the problem of suffering? Some of those classic questions. But I think then as you see, you know, in the latter part of what Ruth and I were looking at, you see some of the conversations change from those more classic, you know, God debate, Stephen Law versus William Lane Craig in Westminster Central Hall, to Jordan Peterson and Susan Blackmore debating, well, can we live without God? You know, do we need God to make sense of life? To, you know, Tom Holland and N.T. Wright talking about the way that the Christian revolution has impacted the West today. To Dave Rubin and John Lennox, you know, having this conversation between this kind of essentially ex-atheist now, David Rubin, saying, well, actually, I've realized there might be more going on in the world, and so on. And I just think we've gradually seen the conversation change to... And I think a lot of it is to do with the fact that actually I think the New Atheism, to some extent, is now in the back window. It kind of has fizzled out or imploded, I would even argue. It really splintered into all kinds of warring factions at one point. And I think to that extent, there's been a rise of a new kind of conversation around God, quite a positive one, I think, from these interesting intellectual but secular thinkers like Jordan Peterson and Tom Holland and Douglas Murray and others, where they're asking, well, can we actually live without the Christian story? What do we do in place of this? And where is culture going without it? And that's probably where we've seen a lot of the conversations end up with The Unbelievable Show in more recent years. And I think it ties directly into what you were saying there, Vince, about those kinds of questions that are coming up. It's people aren't so much asking the question, does God exist? They're asking, how do I make sense of life? Mm. What do I do with the stuff going around? Now, I think the question of God's existence is very relevant to that. It's just that person may not particularly recognize it in that moment. And so for me, it's apologetics has to be about being ready to not answer the questions people were asking, frankly, 17 years ago when the show began, but answering the questions people are asking right now and showing why Christianity may just make sense of that particular question they're asking now.
Vince, do you mind just quickly jump in there? So I guess... For people who are asking those questions, that's one thing. But what would you say, Justin, to the people who aren't even really asking those questions? I guess that, you know, that are just, for want of a better word, kind of apathetic to whether there is a God. It's not that it's not relevant. It's just I'm not even thinking about these big questions. Do you think there's a kind of, I mean, I assume the answer is yes, that you think there's a place for apologetics for that. But where do we even start with that? Because it's not even that there's questions. It's kind of going levels and levels back from there, isn't it?
Yeah. I think they may well be apathetic to the question of God and to the question even of, you know, some of those big questions of meaning and purpose and so on. But they're probably not apathetic about everything in their life. They've probably got some things they are passionate about. And I think that's where you have to always start with people, is to kind of understand, well, what does interest you? What does turn you on? What does get you going and make you, you know, is it sport? Is it your family? Is it some issue around justice or injustice that you're facing? And I think it's always possible to find a connection point. And once you kind of get behind that and understand why someone is so passionate about that particular thing, I think you've then got the opening to a conversation about, well, why does that matter in the end? And kind of open it out to those bigger questions, you know, about life and purpose and everything else. And it may not be that every single thing is an opening to kind of ultimately a gospel conversation or talking about Jesus or anything like that. But you may just find that as you actually try to meet someone where they are in the interest that they have and genuinely try to understand them, you may just find interesting connection points that, you know, you never realized were there. And you might just find that then you start talking on a level where they're actually, turns out, might be more open to talking about issues around spirituality or life or whatever it might be. And I'd say I've seen that frequently on the show, where I've even, an example comes to mind of someone who came on the show some time ago as an atheist and said, was very much a dogmatic sort of, you know, we don't need religion, we can kind of do without it now kind of approach to life. But then later on, several years later, got in touch with me and said, I've been through some real emotional heartache and difficult stuff recently, Justin, and I'm reconsidering everything that I once thought about religion and realizing the value that exists. Now, he hadn't at that point converted to Christianity, but he'd suddenly realized why people reach out to something bigger than themselves a lot of the time. And I just think sometimes it's about kindling a friendship and a relationship until that moment comes for that person when maybe a door opens and they realize, actually, maybe there is something in this God stuff. Maybe I shouldn't have dismissed it so quickly. That would be where I would start with it. Anyway.
I love that Unbelievable and you, Justin, have had the courage to move into those questions in some ways which are more difficult, harder to delineate, at times uncomfortable when you haven't had a lot of conversations or experience in the conversations already in the directions that culture has moved. And, you know, from my perspective as a Christian, every question has a true answer and all truth is grounded in God. So whatever someone's starting point is, I think there's something incarnational there. You know, we sort of go and start where someone is. But if every question has a true answer and all truth is grounded in God, there has to be, as you're saying, some connection point. There has to be some starting point for a bridge between where someone is and those deeper questions of life. I love the approach of the show. I've been a fan and someone who has really just benefited greatly from it. And a big part of that for me has been the tone of the show. It's interesting earlier you saying, you know, you're not a conflict prone guy, but you've sort of started a show that's based on disagreement in some way. And most people that do that actually then move towards an adversarial tone. That's sort of the natural, you know, progression. And I feel like, perhaps even more significant than the content of the show, which has been so significant, has been maybe the tone that you have modeled and encouraged in a society that in some ways has moved in a different direction in terms of the way that we disagree. So I just feel like even when Unbelievable was starting, you know, there's almost a greater need now for not only the content, but the form of disagreement that it's able to model. I was going to read here just a couple of comments about that were so encouraging to me about the show. It said, JB, Justin Brierley, was even-handed, totally free of aggression, and he always kept the conversation within the audience's understanding and interest. I'm an atheist and fully convinced of Daniel Dennett's position. I felt completely welcome as a listener, and I'll definitely come back to this channel. Someone else. I mean, you couldn't have written it any better than that, you know?
I was going to say, I'm sure that was my wife just pretending to be an atheist on the comment section.
Someone says, always fair, always civil, never straw-manning, always giving opportunity for rebuttal. And so that, to me, has just stuck out as much as anything. And that must have been a very intentional choice, Justin, because it's not the natural tide of our culture. It's not the natural tide of a show that's framed around disagreement. So tell us a little bit about why you made that choice and how you made that choice.
I think in a sense, it wasn't that I went in terribly intentionally, but I've always just have been someone who always felt that if we were going to do this properly, then we needed to hear both sides and we needed to be respectful of both sides. And I'll be frank, you know, it hasn't always been easy to hold that line, because there have been sometimes pressures, you know, from people wanting it to be more combative, wanting it to be more kind of, you know, the winner takes all approach, as some people like to have. But I found that in the big scheme of things, as you say, Vince, that the tone of the conversation matters so much more often than whoever won or lost one particular debate, if you like, because actually I think what people have come back for, whether they're Christians or non-Christians listening or watching the show, is the idea that this is a kind of a space where people will be heard. People will be, there'll be honest conversations. There won't be an agenda to sort of for one person to win over another, but we're going to try and do things right, do things fairly. And I think that is different, sadly, to the way it often gets portrayed in other parts of the media. I think it's very much in contradistinction to social media, where sadly echo chambers reign and you tend to only hear the same perspective as the one you already agree with. And that's the way the algorithms are all set up. And so like you, I felt like something like Unbelievable has become more important over the years as we've seen that happen. And a place where you genuinely will hear different perspectives coming together for hopefully a fruitful, respectful dialogue. And we leave it to the listening audience every time to go away and make their own choices, make their own decisions about what they think, and leave the rest, you know, in their hands and ultimately from my position in God's hands as well.
So Justin, how do we replicate that, whatever position we're coming from, when we're having these conversations with people of differing opinions, whether whoever's listening is atheist, skeptic, agnostic, Christian, how do we replicate that tone that you have
in our own conversations?
In our own conversations.
Yeah. I think it's about, I've felt increasingly now that we talk about Christian confidence in apologetic circles, but confidence for me isn't actually about knowing all the arguments and being able to kind of demolish someone in a debate. I think some people think that's what Christian confidence is. I think it's actually about being able to listen generously and openly to someone. And it's helpful to know what you believe and why you believe it when you do that. But actually the confidence comes in actually being able to just hear someone else's perspective and not to recoil or have a knee-jerk reaction of fear or kind of, I've got to answer this person, you know, immediately. It's about letting them have their say, about being willing to listen, engage, to learn from their perspective, but certainly to offer your own response. But to keep the conversation going, not to close it down, not to kind of basically say, you're such an idiot and you know, I'm just on a higher intellectual plane than you are. Confidence is actually about genuinely engaging, interacting, learning. And I think that often speaks volumes more, actually, than just having all the best arguments. It's basically, you know, 1 Peter 3:15, where it says, always be ready to give a reason for the hope that you have, but do this with gentleness and respect. And hopefully it's the gentleness and respect bit that we've also been able to model on the show.
I can't believe it's taken us that long of the show to get to 1 Peter 3:15.
Well done. We held off pretty
there
long.
You go.
That's great. One person said, Unbelievable brings reason to an unreasonable and crazy world. And another person said, we must have more of this in our society. So I love that. I love that the show and your work, Justin, has shown that something can be popular without picking a fight. And I think, you know, somewhere deep down, we actually do long to disagree well. We long deep down for reconciliation between opposing views, which is really at the heart of the gospel. Okay, we've gone for a while, so my final question.
We have. It's been a long one.
My final question is my most important one. When will you be coming back on Unbelievable as a guest to talk about your book?
Yes, I do have a book coming out. I'll waive it. This is a pre-release copy, actually. It's called The Surprising Rebirth of Belief in God. And it very much picks up on what we were saying about the fact that over the last several years, I think the conversation has changed on God. And I think we maybe are due for the tide of faith coming back in again. That's my optimistic thesis in this book. And as we see interesting secular intellectuals like Jordan Peterson and Tom Holland and Douglas Murray and Ian McGilchrist and others sort of making, I think, the case for God again, even to a secular audience. And as I see so many converts to Christianity, people who are crossing the line to faith because they've kind of got tired of the secular materialist narrative. And so it's a book that I'm hopeful will you know, be of interest in this cultural moment that we're currently living through. And I would be delighted to come back on the Unbelievable Show.
If we'll have you, Justin.
That's right. I knew we needed to get the commitment while you were on the air. So that's excellent. My actual final question, 17 and a half years, having these conversations in the public square, brilliant minds, opposing views, people of deep faith and deep conviction. Just, I guess, for the audience, for the listeners, what personal encouragement would you leave them with?
I would just say keep having the conversation. We've had a little bit of a motto in one way or another on the show of conversations matter. Keep the conversation going. Don't fall into the echo chambers. yes, hold your convictions as strongly as you wish to, but always make sure that we leave room for conversations and debating these things and having a proper dialogue. And it's amazing what can happen. I've been stunned by the way in which conversations have changed my life, have changed other people's life through the 17 and a half years I've been doing the show. And I feel sure that God will continue to transform things going forward as people continue to have those kinds of conversations.
Mm, well said. I'll throw it to you, Justin, well, to finish the show however you would like.
Okay. Well, why don't we leave it to Ruth? Ruth, would you... We very rarely ever pray on Unbelievable, so I'm going to break my own rule. Wow. just on this edition.
It's your last show. Break all the rules.
I can do what I like on my last edition of the show. Yeah. Ruth, I'd be delighted if you would pray for the show, for all that will come, because this is not the end of an era. It's the beginning of a new season for the show, and I just know that God's got many more things in store for the show going forward.
Sure thing. But I want to thank you so much for Unbelievable. Thank you for the way that it tackles really difficult but important conversations. As Justin's just said, conversations that really, really matter. And I just ask that you will give us ridiculous wisdom as we take the show forward. Help us to follow Justin's example of facilitating discussions where people are able to share opposing views in a really civilized and loving way. God, will you just help us to ensure that every Unbelievable listener feels heard, regardless of what position they're coming from? And God, I just want to thank you for Justin. I want to thank you so much for everything that he's done, but also for who he is, for his humility, for the way that he is just such a blessing to so many people. And God, I ask that you will bless him and his family as he sets out on this new journey. Will you just fill him with your presence? Will you fill your presence with him every step of the way? And God, will you be with all of us as we attempt to facilitate these life-changing dialogues? And we pray all this in Jesus' name, trusting that you can do immeasurably more than we could ever ask or imagine. Amen.
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 Well, thank you so much, Vince and Ruth. It's been lovely to share this final edition of my show with you, but I look forward to listening to many more from my podcast and on YouTube and wherever else it appears. So God bless you guys, and thank you so much. And just before we finish up, just want to send a huge thank you to the Premier Unbelievable team. Ruth Jackson, just an amazing person. Ben Cutting, our digital supremo. Phil Maltz, who makes everything look amazing. And Peter Byram, the most organized person in the world and a loyal friend too. Also, shout out to Nancy Gifford, who'll be leading the Premier Unbelievable department forward. And huge thanks as well to all of my Premier colleagues, way too many to number, who've been part of the journey for over 20 years. But most of all, thanks to you, the listener, whether you've been with us since the beginning or more recently, whether you think of yourself as an atheist, a Christian or something else, thank you so much for being part of this. But as I said, this is not an ending. It's the beginning of some amazing new content from the show. Look out for all of the exciting stuff to come, including, of course, the rest of this year's big conversation. And you'll doubtless hear my voice again occasionally on the podcast, as there'll be some classic replays coming your way in weeks to come, including next week when the full edition of one of my favourite shows from the archive that I mentioned earlier, John Lennox and Dave Rubin, will be aired. And God willing, I will be continuing to bring Thinking Faith to Christians and skeptics for a long time to come. So God bless you. Keep those conversations going.